Welcome to Tashma, the podcast where you get to listen in on Hadar's Beit Midrash. I'm Rabbi Avi Kellett. To what extent is Jewish law fake or real? Is halacha a game where you can say whatever you want? Or does a ruling, once issued, create a new reality? Rav Michael Rosenberg, in his class, Making Sense of Insensible Food Laws, explores this question through the lens of kashrut. I love these questions, and the fact that Rav Michael's answer is neither. Let's listen.
Welcome to Physical Truth or Rabbinic Power Play, Making Sense of Insensible Food Laws. And I want to start with two stories, one of which I imagine is familiar to most, if not all of you, and one of which I imagine is less familiar. So the first story I want to share with you is a story that's attributed to all sorts of different authorities about a rabbi somewhere. Again, it's clearly apocryphal because it's told about lots of different rabbis, who gets brought a chicken and asks if the chicken is kosher or treif, and responds, that chicken is kosher. And then someone brings in a chicken with an identical problem and says, that chicken is treif. And the students are around the rabbi, and they saw the rabbi respond to two identical chickens with opposite responses. And they're like, Rabbi, why did you tell the first person that their chicken was kosher and the second person their chicken was treif? They're the same chicken. And the rabbi responds, well, the first person is poor and would not be able to buy a second chicken before Shabbos. And the second people is wealthy and would be able to buy another chicken before Shabbos. And this is a sort of questionable case where it could go either way. And so for the rich person, be strict, and for the poor person, be lenient. There are lots of problems with that story. But for now, I just want to sort of take that story at face value of, you know, well, I'll just share that story for now. And we're not going to go into the sort of ethical and classist problems, but that story, I imagine, is well known to many of you. The second story I want to start with is a story told among Chabad Hasidim about, I'm forgetting now which Rebbe it was. I think the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, it doesn't matter, but one of the Lubavitcher Rebbes, who receives a letter from a Lubavitcher Chassid who says, I have been diagnosed with a certain kind of disease, and the doctors tell me I'm going to die within the year. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, move to Eretz Yisrael and you will be fine. And the Chassid moves to Eretz Yisrael and miraculously survives, goes beyond the year and lives a long and healthy life. The person writes back and says, how did you know that moving to Eretz Yisrael would cure me? The Tzemach Tzedek writes back and says, the disease you have is a disease that is also common among cows, and the poskim talk about it. An animal that's going to die within a year is considered a treifa, and you're not allowed, that's not a kosher animal. And the Mechaber and the Ramah, Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Moshe Isserles, disagree about whether this disease would render the animal likely to die within 12 months or not. The Mechaber rule does not make them die within 12 months, and therefore it's not a treifa. The Ramah rules that it would die within 12 months, therefore it is a treifa. In Eretz Yisrael, they hold like the Mechaber. And so I told you to move to Eretz Yisrael, where the Mechaber is correct, and that's why you lived more than 12 months. Because the Mechaber says that disease doesn't kill you within 12 months. In Poland, where the Ramah says you're going to die, you would have died. Okay? Now, why do I share those two stories side by side? On the face of it, they seem to be kind of opposite stories, right? The first story is kind of telling you the physical reality of what's going on is irrelevant to kashrus. The exact same chicken for a poor person is kosher, and for a wealthy person is rich. It doesn't really matter what the sort of physical reality is of this chicken in question, right? That's story number one. Story number two seems to say the exact opposite, right? Which is that, no, in fact, it's so real that what rabbis decide is the physical reality of the disease will actually determine whether you survive or not. You can move to Eretz Yisrael, where the Mechaber reigns supreme, and now you will live more than 12 months, right? And we can often sort of think of this as like the first model is, well, the rabbis just do whatever they want, right? And by the rabbis, now I don't mean just Chazal, but Rishonim and Acharonim as well, right? All of halacha is just a power play, and they have a conclusion they want to get to, and they'll just say whatever they need to say. And if I want to say for the poor person that's kosher, I'll say that. If I want to say for the wealthy person that's treif, I'll say that. And the second one says, no, this is all very real. It's so real that actually it determines reality, right? But it's perfectly in line with reality. And I think those are often the ways people think about food laws. Either it's just rabbinic power plays, or it's got to be totally real. And if there isn't actual molecules of dairy in this pot, then this pot's not really dairy. And if we say the pot's dairy, it must be because there are actual molecules of dairy in the pot. And to give away the ending, you can all leave right now if you want. I'm going to argue that it is not about either rabbinic power plays or physical reality, or at least I should say it's not exclusively about physical reality. Physical reality certainly plays a role, but that as much or more so than it's about physical reality, it's about our experience of physical reality. That how we perceive what's going on is an essential part of what we rule. And of course, that doesn't dismiss physical reality, right? I can't drink a bottle of water and think it's orange juice, right? Because chemically it's not. But I could drink a bottle of like chemically produced scented water and maybe think it's orange juice, right? And so that question of perception is going to be what I'm going for as a sort of motivating factor in a number of cases that otherwise seem quite strange. So we're going to look at three examples. And the first example is, as I've labeled it here, a treif pot, question mark. Kedera shebishel ba basar. A pot in which one has cooked meat, lo yevashel ba chalav. One may not cook milk in it. This is obvious to all of you, but the Shulchan Aruch had to say it somewhere, right? This is the source, well, it actually comes from the Gemara, but this is the source of the law that once you've cooked meat in a pot, you may not have dairy in that pot. It's not just about having meat and milk together, but actually there, you know, the pot itself becomes meaty. Ve'im bishel ba besoch me'es la'es, aser b'no sein tam. And if I now cook in that meat pot some dairy, within 24 hours, me'es la'es means within 24 hours, if within 24 hours I cook in that meat pot, it is forbidden if there was enough meat flavor in the pot to give meat flavor to the milk, right? If you've heard about shishim, about 60 being the sort of standard, that's the approximation we use to say if there's 60x of the treif thing, then I'm not going to taste the treif thing. But if there's less than 60x, then I will taste the treif thing. 60 is just a stand-in for am I likely to taste the flavor or not. So he says, if I cook dairy in my meat pot within 24 hours, the dairy is treif, assuming that there is enough meat flavor to give flavor to the dairy.
I thought the first sentence just said that it's always forbidden and not allowed.
Yeah, it does say that, and it's not allowed, but if I did it, it's only forbidden if there's enough meat flavor in the pot to give flavor to the dairy.
So it's not actually not allowed? A Torah of all sort of kind of thing?
Kind of, yeah. It's a lechatchila b'dieved thing. Lechatchila, I'm not supposed to cook mac and cheese in my meaty pot. B'dieved, if I did, I have to ask the question, is there enough meat flavor in the pot that I would taste it in my mac and cheese? And if there isn't, even though I shouldn't have done it, I'm not held accountable. It's kind of like if I'm driving 70 in a 65 mile per hour zone, I'm breaking the law. I'm not supposed to do that. But I'm probably not going to get a ticket for it, right? That's lechatchila. And, right, lechatchila, I'm not supposed to drive that fast, but b'dieved, I'm probably not going to take it. If I drive 85, God willing, I will.
Does the material of the pot matter? I know that Pyrex, I mean, right, they still sell them, but you can have, like, stovetop glass pots that are entirely glass.
Yes, the material does matter. It's not going to be our focus. I'm not going to go into the details of how it matters. We can talk about that later if you want. But, yes, the material does matter, potentially. Reese.
So, when it says, like, if there's enough to be tasted, it's like, I'm confused. Why there's the two different criteria of 24 hours and that if there's enough to be tasted? Like, is it saying that if it's within 24 hours, there's probably enough there for it to be tasted? Or does it have to meet, like, both criteria?
Almost exactly right, the first thing you said, except okay, we're going to reverse it. It's not that if it's within 24 hours, there's definitely enough to be tasted, but rather, if it's more than 24 hours, then whatever meaty flavor was there is going to be degraded enough that's not a problem. We'll talk more, that's actually going to become our focus in a moment. But within 24 hours, it might be a problem, might not. And I should have read one more line before I took questions, actually, because the Ramah adds here, "Bitzarich l'sha'er neged kol akadera." Right? How do I know if there's enough meat flavor in the pot to make my mac and cheese taste meaty? So says the Ramah, the only way I can know is I have to be very conservative about this. And I have to assume, well, if when I cooked meat in my pot, right, why is there meat flavor in a pot ever? And we all know that pots actually do have flavor, right? Maybe not as much as they used to because of our new materials, going back to what you said, Ariel, but there often is flavor contained in a pot. But I don't know how much flavor there is. So, right, I assume that some meat molecules get into my pot. And so I have to imagine, well, if the entire meat of my pot, let's say, left and went into the meat, and all the meat went back and replaced the sides of the pot, that's the maximum amount of meat I could possibly have in my pot, right? So even though I surely don't have, you know, a pot's worth of meat. And when I say a pot's worth of meat, I don't mean the pot is full of meat, but rather, if imagine a pot made entirely out of meat. That's the most meat I could possibly have in my pot. I obviously don't have that much, but that's the most I could have. And since there's no better way to estimate, I estimate that way. So I say, okay, the volume of the sides and bottom of this pot is 60 grams. That, and there's 1 gram of mac and cheese in here. Yeah, so that would be okay, right? Oh, no, it's the opposite. No, the other way around. But you get what I'm saying, right? So I measure against the pot, and that's how I know if there's enough flavor. So if it's within 24 hours, I have to measure. If it's more than 24 hours, we'll see what's going to happen in a moment. Hila.
Back to the first question you answered about Asso and Val. I understood those as being about the food itself, like whether or not you can eat it, rather than about the action. It sounded from your answer like maybe it was also about the action.
No, what's about the action, about the cooking, is lo yivashel b'chalav. Lo yivashel b'chalav means lechatchila, I may not cook mac and cheese in my meaty pot, but im bishelba, asur b'no sein tam, means b'diyevet, it's only forbidden if there was enough meat to give flavor to the mac and cheese.
So I think my question is, I understood that as meaning the food.
Exactly.
But that the action itself is still a forbidden, like it's not that the action is like now permitted.
No.
Because you did it by accident or because you did it in this b'diyevet framework. It's still a problem. It's just,
correct.
You can still eat the food.
That's what I was trying to say, and if I didn't say that, then I apologize. Yeah. Aval. Im shaha me'es la'es kodem shebishelba. It waited 24 hours, right? I cooked meat in this pot Sunday at noon. This is my pot, I guess. And then Monday at 12:01, I made mac and cheese in this pot by mistake. That's implied here. Havale no sein tam leaf gum. Whatever meat flavor was left in my pot after 24 hours is gross. It doesn't actually improve anything. No sein tam leaf gum, we could spend a lot of time on. We're not going to. I'm going to ask you just to take for granted that this is true, and you can raise objections after the faculty panel. Once 24 hours have gone by, it's a negative flavor, so it doesn't trap up the food. Umutara tavshil, right? And therefore, the mac and cheese I made at 12:01, again, I still shouldn't have done it, but the mac and cheese that I made after 24 hours have passed is permitted. This is all the setup still, right? We're about to get to the part that I think is the sort of insensible piece, at least on its face. Aval hakadeira asur levashelba lo basar velo chalav. If you read here, don't read the next line yet. Right? But the pot, right? So the mac and cheese is okay, but the pot is forbidden to cook in it either meat or milk. So someone tell me, what is the status of the pot? If you read the next line, don't answer. But someone who did not yet read the next line, what's the status of the pot? The mac and cheese is kosher. B'diyeved. Yeah, Reese?
But the pot is treif.
The pot is treif is a normal, reasonable reading of that. But if we want to be very precise, what does he technically say? Yeah?
Parv.
What do you mean by parv?
Well, can't have meat or milk.
Okay.
But can have neither
yeah.
of it.
A parv pot is a concept that only exists nowadays when we're rich and have lots of pots and pans, right? Like the idea that I have a pot that I don't use for either meat or milk. And when we say a parv pot nowadays, we mean like, I could in theory use it for meat or milk. Once I did, I can only use it for that thing. But I keep it parv, right? That's what people mean nowadays when they say a parv pot. But the Ramah says, a valshar devari mutter, right? This is a pot in which I'm allowed to cook broccoli, but I'm not allowed to cook meat in it, and I'm not allowed to cook milk in it. It's forbidden for meat or for milk, but I am allowed to cook parv in it. And that is not that's not the normal meaning of parv pot. And if you stop to think about it, right, how did I explain the measuring against the pot? Well, the maximum amount of meat that you can have in that pot is equal to the volume of the material of the pot itself, right? Well, what's the status of this pot? Does it have meat in it, or does it have milk in it? It kind of has both, so you'd think we should be treif, but that's not what the Ramah says the Mechaber means. And by the way, this is not a disagreement. This actually is a correct interpretation of the Mechaber. We know that that's what the Mechaber actually meant, right? I'm not saying it's treif because it has meat and milk in it, and I'm not saying it's kosher because it has neither meat or milk in it, but somehow I can only use it for broccoli. And physically, that doesn't actually make sense, right? Because either it's got meat and milk in it, it should be a treif pot, or it's got neither in it, so it should be used for one. Or I can imagine saying, well, the milk flavor, no, because like the meat flavor is degraded, but we don't say any of those things. We say this pot can be used only for parv things. How do you make sense of that? Why am I not allowed to cook meat in the pot, right? If it has meat and milk flavor, I shouldn't be able to cook broccoli in it. Any bold speculations?
Is it because the pot is no sein tam leaf gum, but somehow only the broccoli?
Okay. So say it out.
Like it's no sein tam leaf gum in such a way that it gives tam leaf gum to parv things, but it creates an iser if it gives it to something that is, you know.
Okay, so that I'm going to push back and say it doesn't really. You're like.
I'm trying.
Why would it be negative for broccoli, but it would be positive for something else? That doesn't really quite work, right? So we're going to nix that possibility.
Maybe because there's no way to conclude the actual status of one, like which one prevailed, assuming that one did. And that way it's too risky to use it for either meat or milk.
But what if, but if I can't conclude which one it is, then maybe it's both and I shouldn't use it for broccoli either.
Well, yeah, if we're being logical.
Okay. Yeah, and my starting point, and the starting point of, I would say, all the faculty at Hadar, but certainly many of us are students of a rabbi named Rav Elisha Anshelovich, and we're very influenced by his approach, which is that everything, even the stuff that seems totally absurd, there's actually a logical way to understand it. If you haven't figured that out yet, it's just because you haven't learned the material deeply enough yet. So I want to get to a place where this actually makes sense.
It's like there are multiple layers of doubt here. We don't know whether there's meat. We don't know whether there's milk. We don't know if the taste is left. And, like, therefore, there may be both meat and milk in it, but it's not at a level that it's worth prohibiting. And he's, like, trying to be lenient because people are poor and don't own a lot of milk.
Okay, so there's a lot of doubt, and I'm going to believe, but there's a lot of doubt. That doubt might include the possibility that there is meat and milk in there, right? And if we take kosher seriously, I don't want broccoli that tastes like a cheeseburger. I mean, I do, but I'm not allowed to have it. I actually don't. I don't like cheese, but I figure some of you do. Yeah, so that doesn't quite work either.
If we are thinking, like, well, experientially, and, like, you know, a person tasting the food, like, the taste of this broccoli, or tasting whatever food that they might theoretically put in this pot. Like, if it's meat, like, they're going to be thinking in the back of their mind, like, oh, like, it's possible that, like, you know, this cheese, mac and cheese that I just made, like, is giving some sort of, like, positive taste and, like, you know, like, whatever, meaning, like, it just might be, like, really, like, stressful and, like, how am I even going to be dealing with this, whatever, like, it, I think what it would end up kind of just doing is, like, leaving you to just be, like, okay, like, I can't really even, like, deal with either meat or milk being cooked in this, but part of it almost seems like it's not stressful in either direction. Either it's, like, no teen time here or no teen time there, but it doesn't matter, and, like, I'm going to be a little more aggressive.
I'm going to come back to that in a moment because I think I'm going to tweak it to make my offering, but that's moving in the direction I want to move in, and what I liked especially was the sort of focus on experience because, as I said at the outset, that's why I want to argue is behind most of these laws.
I think, like, a cast iron pan where, like, it does have flavors that's left over. So, like, clearly you can't put more meat in it because it just had dairy within the past, like, 24 hours. You can't put more dairy because it's a meat pan, but if you cook broccoli...
Wait, let me stop you there. What do you mean, because it's a meat pan?
Well, it's initially a meat pan.
Okay, and so why may I not put...
But you can cook broccoli because it will replace that, like, remnant flavor with the broccoli flavor.
Okay, not a detour at all. I think, actually, Davi plus Ari equals Michael, right? What do I mean by that? Let's start with... If we believed that there was actually problematic meat flavor in here, then I would need to say, like, and by the way, the broccoli is going to be meaty, right? And by definition, we actually are saying that after 24 hours, there's not problematic meat flavor in there, right? In which case, why not put milk in there? And if we thought there was problematic dairy flavor in there, I'd have to say something about that also, right? And certainly, if I thought there was problematic meat flavor in there, I would say you can't cook anything in there. So fundamentally, what we're saying is after 24 hours, we don't really think there's a problematic flavor in there at all. So what's the problem putting it in the pot in the first place? Well, let's imagine now you've had this, and you're right to go to a cast iron pan, right? This is what I alluded to before, but I'll say it explicitly now. It's hard for us to understand a lot of kosher laws because our materials are so non-porous. But if you think about cast iron or cheres, like ceramic Dutch ovens, or frat houses that don't clean their dishes very well, right? All those are places where, like, actually kosher makes a lot more sense. Right? So I've had a meat pan for 6 months, right? And I've, you know, I see that pan, I'm like, oh, it's, I must have marked it in some way, or it's the only kind of pan like that, because otherwise I would have made mistakes in the past already, right? So what do I think when I see that meat pan with some mac and cheese in it? Even if there's no problematic meat flavor left in it, it's been degraded for 6 months, right? But what do I think when I see it?
It's ancient
treif. Ew! That's treif! That's my meat pan with mint cheese in it. But I also just had a very traumatic experience of, I actually did, right? The pot we're talking about was a meaty pan that I then saw mac and cheese in. And what do I see when I see that? It's like, that's treif, right? So every time I see dairy in there, that's a trigger of my trauma, which I don't mean that jokingly, right? For folks who take their kosher seriously, it's a trauma to see that mac and cheese in their meat pot. And so every time I see either meat or milk, it creates a dissonance, thank you, right? That can't be right. When I see the broccoli in there, it doesn't trigger in the same way, right? Because broccoli would have gone in my meat pan or in my dairy pan. And so I want to submit to you that the only way really to understand this the way that makes sense is that we're saying, fundamentally, on the level of physical reality, there isn't any flavor here that's going to make your broccoli problematic, right? But psychologically, It won't make your broccoli problematic, but it would make your meat or your dairy problematic. It would actually feel like either this is wrong, I know the meat pot and I'm seeing dairy in it, or seeing the dairy in it will remind me of that moment of having had that transgression in my past, and I don't want to remember that mistake I made. So that's my argument.
Practically, if you think that you can just make hot food in the pot, and assuming we don't have a whole part of set of dishes and servingware, can you put the broccoli on either meat or dairy plates where you're, you know, actually consuming one or the other at a meal?
Great. So the short answer is the most conservative ruling, which I'll just say because that keeps me safe, is you would treat this as meat at that point, but that's actually a big machlokas, and we could have a whole elective on that. Actually, we would need two electives on it to get through it.
It isn't clear to me, and so I wonder, I don't know if there's more text or if you can answer this. Is it mutar lechatchila or mutar bedirbet? Like, is it still better for me to cook in a different pot, or is this pot now totally fine? I can mix it into my dishware as long as I remember that it's, like, that pot, and I can only cook part
Great.
Of it, but, like, we're good.
Look at the Ramaz language. Aval shar dvarim mutar. When he says that, if I say mutar, that means mutar lechatchila. So the Rama is saying, and again, this is clearly what the Machaber himself means. Yeah, this pot is now fine to cook parv in. And it's not like, I want to emphasize this, it's not like the way we use parv pots nowadays, because I don't have any parv pots anymore because they're all screwed up. They're all dairy. But that's the point, right? When I screw up nowadays and make a parv pot dairy, that's fine. It's just dairy now. This pot I am not allowed to use with dairy, and I'm not allowed to use with meat. I'm only allowed to use with parv. And again, the only way I can understand that is as reflecting my psych. Again, the physical reality that there's not real problematic flavor in there is important, but it's not the whole story. My psychology is the piece that has to come in here to actually explain why it's still somewhat problematic.
Would someone be able to argue that because they weren't used to having this parv pot mindset, that it actually would be like, I'm not going to use the word traumatizing, but more difficult for someone to internalize
yeah.
and then mess up again, which would just be hard for
yeah.
that person again psychologically, because they're more likely to mess up because they're not used to it.
I don't know of anyone who makes that argument, but I can totally imagine someone making that argument.
I also just, I feel like there are so many things in kashrut where you make one mistake and then your whole thing is treif.
Yeah,
like,
so...
And that does not appear to take psychological consequences into
Great.
Regard.
So I will say kashrus is an area where the mainstream practice among self-defined kosher keepers is generally much stricter than what the books say. And at some point I would love for Rav Eitan to give an online shiur on kashrus in his framework, which he spent a lot of time thinking about. Okay. The truth is, it is very often not the case that one mistake actually traipses everything up. In fact, it's turning off the recording for a moment, it's very hard to trace something up, right? It's very easy to make a mistake that you shouldn't have done, but it's very hard actually to make something trace. Not very hard, relatively hard.
I was wondering about a scenario where you don't actually put dairy in your meat pot, like the pot maybe was parve or something, or you mislooked at your label or something, but you still have that like visceral, like really strong reaction when you see that pot, and because you initially thought made a rave, would you then?
Sorry, I'm not sure. I'm not. The scenario was the pot was originally
parve, we'll call it.
Meaning it had neither meat nor milk in it ever.
Yes.
Okay.
You put your mac and cheese in it.
Yeah.
When you look at it, you think that you put your mac and cheese in a meat pot.
Why am I thinking that?
Because maybe you looked at your label wrong, or you have similar pots. For some reason, you never actually made the mistake, but you still experienced a mistake.
Great.
Would you then respond the same way, even though there was never any physical problem?
Great. That's a reasonable question to ask based on the way I'm explaining this. And the fact that no one says that might be pushback on what I'm saying. But I actually think it's not. Because I think what we would say is, the trauma is not the same when I'm like, oh, well, for a moment I think I tripped it up, and then, oh, no, it's actually fine. Right? That's different from, you know, my cousin tells a story of, you know, they had a live-in nanny living with them, and my cousin asked her just to help ready-made pasta with meat sauce for the kids, and the nanny, like, in her first week there, like, to go out of her way to be helpful, like, presented with, like, Parmesan cheese on top. And my cousin sees it in her kitchen and freaks out and doesn't think to call her rabbi. In the moment, she just picks it all up and throws it in the garbage, right? And she said, like, in retrospect, I don't know why I did that. I should call the rabbi to find out what I needed to do. But the visceral reaction was so intense. And I don't think you have that kind of visceral reaction when you realize right away you made that it wasn't actually a mistake. Let's turn to a second example. Treif Spoon's question, flavor. Source number two. Hatochev kaf choleves bekedera shel basar. I take a dairy spoon and I accidentally dip it into a pot full of meat. O ipcha. Or I did the opposite. Doesn't really matter. Well, to keep it simple, I'm taking a dairy spoon, dipping it into a meat pot. Misharim bekol ma shenitchav mimenu bekedera. We measure, right? We just learned in the previous case, I have to measure against the volume of the kli, of the vessel that goes into the, that is problematic. So I say, how much of the spoon went into the pot? I have to have 60 against that volume, right? This is not the main thing we're going to focus on, but that's where we're starting, right? The Rama adds something about it has to be within 24 hours based on what we just said, but we're going to skip that for the sake of time and simplicity. The yesh misha omer, shim akaf shel maseches misharim bekulo. And say, if a metal spoon, then you measure against the whole spoon, not just what went into the meat, but the whole thing. Mishum decham miktsas ocham kulo, right? Because metal conducts heat better, and therefore maybe the flavors transfer more. That itself is an interesting thing that I also think we can explain via psychology, but that's not what I want to focus on for the sake of time. And the Rabbah says, usvar rishon ikar, we follow the first opinion. You just measure based on what goes in the pot, not based on the whole spoon. Fine. The next part is what I care about. Im tachav hakaf bakadera shnei pa'amim. If one dipped the spoon in the pot twice, right? So I'm going along cooking. I have my dairy spoon. I'm making a challenge. I stir the pot. Oh, and I forgot three important words. Velo no da bein taim. And I didn't realize in between. So what's the scenario? I have my challenge in the meat pot. I take my dairy spoon. I stir it. Don't realize that I made a mistake yet. Come back and pick it up and stir it a time. If I did that, says the Mechaber, Tzarich shtei pe'amim shishim. Now I don't need 60, let's say there's 12 grams of metal that went into the chalent, of dairy metal that went into the chalent. I don't need 60 times 12, I need 120 times 12 now, because I dipped the spoon in twice. Now let's think about this for a moment. Why, in the previous example, why did we say that we measure against the pot? Because what's the maximum amount of meat flavor that could have gotten into my mac and cheese? The amount of the pot. Right? There can't be more meat in the pot than the volume of the pot itself. Again, when I say volume, I don't mean the volume it contains. I mean the volume of the sides and the bottom. Right. So the same thing here. If I've got 12 grams of dairy spoon that went into my chalent, I know I don't actually have 12 grams of dairy because some of that is actually spoon. But the most possible dairy that I could have gotten into my chalent is 12 grams of dairy. Right. Just because I dipped it in twice doesn't mean there's 24 grams of dairy now. So why would that be? Now the Ramah comes along and says, right? The Ramah says, actually, some say you only need 60 again, and that's how we hold. So an Ashkenaz is not a problem. But the Mechaber, who's normally the lenient voice on food-related issues, here he says, no, actually, I think you need 120 times the volume of the spoon that went into your meat.
I don't really understand what you're measuring. Like, are you trying to determine whether the chalent is treif or whether the spoon is treif?
Great. So whether the spoon is treif is a really complicated seif that I don't want to get into. Okay. So right now we're just talking about whether the food is kosher or not, right? And what I want to know is it possible that I got enough dairy flavor from that spoon that I dipped into my chalent that now I can taste dairy in my chalent? And I can't just taste it to see because if there is dairy, I've eaten treif, right? So I have to do it based on measuring, right? So and like I said before, the maximum amount of dairy that could have gone into my chalent is, if I imagine the spoon was made entirely of dairy and just dissolved into my chalent, that's the most I could have. So a conservative reading would measure against the amount of spoon that went in. But if that happened, then the spoon's already dissolved. Whatever dairy was in the spoon has come out. And if it didn't come out, then I didn't need to measure against it in the first place, right? So why would you ever say that in this case where I dipped the spoon in twice without knowing in between that I need to go 120 times the volume of the spoon that went into the pot, and not merely 60. It's actually a bigger problem. Because if we assume that kashrus is really about physical reality, then why does it matter that I didn't find out about it in between? Right? It's the same darn spoon. Whether I dipped it in the pot, realized, oh crap, I just dipped a dairy spoon in a meat chalent, and then did it again, or I didn't realize in between, it's the same amount of dairy that could possibly get in there. So why in the... in the second case where I realized in whichever case it was, I realized in between, why in that case do I need 120? But the implication you can see, and I'm not going to do it inside, but source number three is talking about, source number three is, points this out. The language of the Shulchan Aruch implies that if I didn't realize in between, then I only need 60. So let's speculate. Why might someone say, where I dipped my spoon in once, where I didn't realize that I made a mistake, and then dipped it in a second time, I need 120 times the volume of the spoon that went in, but where I did realize in between, I only need 60 times the amount of the spoon that went in. Let's speculate boldly.
I think there's some sort of piece about carelessness. I don't know if there's like, when you intentionally put it in, or well, when you knowingly put it in twice, that feels like human error that one can't avoid. You put it in, for some reason something goes on in your head and you do it again without realizing. If you're not conscious of it, it feels like this is like a punishment for that carelessness.
For which carelessness? The carelessness of?
It's hard to...
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. So Joe is saying, he's, if I heard you correctly, I heard you sort of saying both sides of the fence, right? Because on the one hand, if I stuck my dairy spoon in my pot, and I was like, crap, I just stuck a dairy spoon in a challenge, and then 5 minutes later do the same darn thing, that should be really problematic, right? So that makes it more of a problem. So let's say out the upside. How else might I understand what's going on? Yeah, Reese.
If we're, like, saying the idea of, like, making people feel comfortable, if you realize after you've done it twice that you did it twice, you're like, oh, my gosh, I'm so bad at keeping kosher. What am I going to do? And, like, there's twice as much sense of this urgency to, like, add back a layer of comfort or, like, add back a layer of, like, making up for the mistake. You, like, feel the need to do so and, like, make up for it twice as badly.
Fantastic. I've actually never thought about it that way, but I love that framing, which is not to think about this as a punishment that I need 120 times because I did something bad, extra bad, right? If I did something bad, I need 60. If I did something extra bad, I need 120. No, says Reese. I need to reassure myself. This is, by the way, not what I was going to say, but I love this. So I'm going to expand on it a bit, right? I need extra comfort to feel like I can go back to this pot and the spoon to feel, well, the spoon's a different story, actually, but to feel like this challenge is okay, I need that extra level of comfort in saying, you know what, there's so much meat that it absolutely doubly nullified the dairy in the spoon. That's actually what's going to set my mind at ease to feel like when I'm eating my challenge, I'm not actually transgressing. I love that formulation. I hadn't thought of that before, so I really appreciate that.
I'm curious, in the sort of punishment model of the 120 times, why necessarily would the punishment be turning it from 60 into 120 as opposed to saying 10 Hail Marys? Or like, you know,
that's a Christian thing that we don't do, but
why isn't there some other prescriptive punishment?
Great. So first of all, I think before we spoke, I would have a harder time answering you, right. But I think we could say like punishment and comfort actually kind of in this kind of example actually go together, right? And I actually need something to set my mind at ease, right? So I don't feel like I'm eating something treif when I eat that challenge. But I also think that in general we want the sort of punishment to be appropriate to what you did, right? It should be in the same realm. And it's not simply like you have to say extra tachnun because you dipped the spoon in twice. Okay, so I still want to keep digging into why might we need 120, specifically where you didn't realize in between. Joe already gave us part of it. Reese gave us a great way of thinking about it that was on a different axis.
But if you didn't realize you dipped it twice, like what else did you do?
Okay. For me, this is, I think, the fundamental claim here, is that it's true. If I dip my spoon in once, realize it, and then dip it in a second time, that's really bad, right? And that's what Joe was sort of one half of what he was saying. But on the other hand, there's something in effect in my kitchen that I realized it, right? If I'm capable of making the same mistake multiple times without realizing it, then I'm running a sort of not a helter-skelter kitchen, right? Like things are not the way they should be, and I haven't set things up. Now, what all of these share in common, again, Reese's formulation is, I think, a more positive spin on the knas model, right, the punishment model. But I think what they all share in common is, like, it's not a bad... No one really thinks there's twice as much milk in the pot. The machaber, just because he says you need 120 times the volume, doesn't mean the spoon dissolved twice into your chalent. But there's something extra necessary, either because you're running a sloppy kitchen such that you didn't even notice in between that we need to punish you for, or because you're like so stricken with what you've done, you're like, I can't believe I did that dumb thing twice, that you need the comfort to feel like, oh, that really is totally fine. I need an extra level of protection. Either way, it's about my psychology and my experience of things rather than what's physically going on. And that's, for me, the important piece of this.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I would have thought about this before this year would be that the reason why it's 60 times to begin with is that's the, like, minimum calculation you need to do to remove any doubt about the cashew status of the whole mixture. And that's not a punishment-based model at all.
Correct.
So my question would be, is there any way to incorporate the 2 times 60 rationale in a non-punishment under the same sort of reasoning?
Great. There is a complicated way to try to get that to work, right? But what you would have to say is, like, there's something special about milk and meat, which we do have in other cases, where I dip my milk spoon into the chalent, and let's say 12 grams of spoon go into the chalent. So now I've got 12 grams of dairy that goes in the chalent. The chalent's now milk and meat, let's say. And then that milk and meat goes back into the spoon. So now the spoon has absorbed not 12 grams of meat or milk, but 12 grams of meat and milk, which is its own prohibition, its own isser, its own forbidden item. And then the second time, I saw that I'm getting 12 grams of dairy in my pot. I'm getting 12 grams of milk and meat in my pot. If you buy that, great. I find that far-fetched, and I respect the Mechaber too much to think that's what he means. But that is how some of the Acharonim understand the Mechaber.
Do you think it's more far-fetched than the initial thing where I dip my spoon in and now there's the equivalent?
No, because no one really believes that 12 grams of spoon means 12 grams of dairy. It's just that since I don't have a better way to estimate, I have to be on the machmir side. I want to avoid anything potential. That's just a conservative rendering. But no one really thinks that 12 grams of dairy goes into the pot when I dip 12 grams of spoon into the pot. Because it's clearly not a cheese spoon. Although there are such things.
No, but if we don't think it's really so in the first case, why would it not being really so in the second case be an argument against it?
Because I can explain why in the first case we do something that doesn't.
Because that's maximal.
Right. I'm being on the safe side. In the second case, like, even on the safe side, I don't need 60. I mean, I don't need 120. I only need 60.
Part of me is also thinking possibly, like, you're cooking. Well, I guess, like, I was thinking about this on Friday afternoon. But generally, if people sometimes can cook multiple types of food in the kitchen at the same time. Like, theoretically, you know, during the time in which you stirred the first time, forgot, like, during the time in which you forgot, somebody else could have taken that spoon and been like, oh, dairy spoon, let me go stir my dairy pot, puts it back down, and then you get exactly the same amount of cheese.
Yes. That's possible, but the Mechaber doesn't say in a case where that happened.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I was just throwing it out there.
Great.
I just wanted to make sure that I was, like, understanding, like, what you brought up and then, like, a little bit what you were saying and combining it with the comfort issue. But it's like, yeah, it's like, if you made this mistake twice, then, like, yeah, maybe, like, that spoon isn't labeled well. Maybe, like, something else wasn't labeled well. And maybe, like, you're saying, like, you're running a bad kitchen. So is the 120, the first 60 is to make up for the spoon, and then the other 60 to make you feel more comfortable in case you made any other mistakes too?
I think that's, again, in your comfort model, which, again, I hadn't thought about before, so I want to think about it more, but I'm very intrigued by. I think that makes a lot of sense. But again, I don't want to get too, like, focused on, well, it's really got to be, the point is that you're doing something extra, either because you need a punishment because to teach you run a better kitchen, or because you need that comfort to be like, no, that chalent, it really is kosher, right? Despite having not one but two chalent, I can trust that there won't be any traumatic flavor in the chalent.
Okay, this is kind of far-fetched also, especially because there is kind of a different translation. Like, the English isn't a direct translation, because here in Hebrew it says hakaf, and here it says a spoon.
Uh-huh.
But there's kind of two, like, it could be like you take your dairy spoon, you put it in the pot, you're like, oh my God, what do I do? And you, like, throw it in the sink, so you can't use that again. But then you leave in 10 minutes, so you come back and you take a new dairy, still a dairy spoon, but not the same one. And now you're doing it twice, but it's a new one. Or working on maybe what W was saying, like, it now, like, has double the dairy because somebody used it in a dairy pot, so it's, like, been re-dairied. Like, it is actually a 24-gram dairy spoon, because either it's two 12-gram spoons or one that's been redid.
Great. So in the first scenario you're describing, we would say you need 120 times.
Yes.
But I wouldn't say that's ridiculous on physical grounds.
Okay, because it is too different.
Again, leaving aside the fact that measuring against the volume of the spoon to begin with is a chumrah,
yeah,
but a necessary one because I don't have a better way to measure. Yeah, like I really could have 24 grams of dairy in my, well, I couldn't, but maximally I really could have 24 grams of dairy in my challah. So I think that would make sense, right? It's when it's the same spoon without having been dipped a second time, that's when it becomes a problem. So we've been talking about shishim, right? This idea that you need 60 to nullify forbidden flavors. And that is, I imagine, what most people have heard about. Sure, oh yeah, something trefal isn't kosher, you need 60 times. However, that standard of 60 is only true when what we're talking about is what's called lach belach, liquid mixtures, right? I drop some milk into my challah, and now it's all mixed in, and I can't differentiate between the milk and the challah. I go based on, well, how much milk fell in? Is it less than 1/60th of the challah? If so, it's kosher. If it's more than 1/60th, it's tref, because I assume there's a decent chance I could taste the dairy in my challah. However, if I'm talking about discrete items, right? So I didn't drop some milk into a challah, but rather I dropped one trafe Big Mac, whatever. I have three hamburgers, two of which I know are kosher and one of which I know is not kosher, but I don't know which is which. It was the shell game, right? They got mixed together, and I don't know which is the trafe hamburger, which is the kosher hamburgers. That's the case we're going to talk about here in source number 5. Chasicha she'ena ru'uya lis kabed, she'nis arva ba'acheru. So we're not going to go into this not particularly fancy bit. That's an important thing halachically, but it's not relevant to the piece of what we're going to talk about right now. So I've got a chunk of non-kosher meat that gets mixed in with others, and the implication is kosher meat, min b'mino, of the same kind, so I can't differentiate, right? It's not a treif chicken burger and two kosher hamburgers, because that would be obvious, which is the treif one, right? But three things where I can't identify based on appearance. One of them is treif, two of them are kosher. Yavesh b'yavesh, and they're distinct items. They don't meld together like milk in my challah. Chad b'trei, one with two, meaning two kosher and one treif. Batil, the treif hamburger is nullified by the two kosher hamburgers, right? I don't need 60, I just need rove, I just need majority. Umutar leochlan, well, I'll come back to this in a second. It's like majority. As long as more than half of the items are kosher, even though I know there are some non-kosher items in there, they're nullified. And says the Mechaber, umutar leochlan adam echad, right? And one person is allowed to eat all three. I know I've got one treif burger here, but I'm allowed to eat all three of those burgers, even though one of them I know is treif. I don't know which one. Kol achas bifnei atzma. I'm not allowed to eat them all three together. I can't put them like on a double Big Mac with like buns in between and eat them like this, but I can eat burger number one, burger number two, burger number three, even though I know that one of them is treif. Aval, lo yochal shlosh tam yachad. I may not eat them all together. V'yesh misho oser leochlam adam echad, and there is someone who forbids eating one person eating them all, afilu ze achar ze, even one after the other. So Joe and I, he can eat two of them and I can eat one, I can eat two and he can eat one, doesn't really matter. But the point is, even though I know one of us, even though we're both from Jews, even though I know one of us is eating treif, it's okay. That's the stringent view here. The lenient view is Joe can eat all three of them, one after the other. The stringent view is we have to divide the burgers between the two of us. Yeah.
Is this lechatchila
also? It says mutar. So at this point, it's lechatchila, meaning once they've been mixed, I'm allowed to do this, but I'm not allowed to say, okay, I need more burgers, and I don't have enough kosher burgers, so I'm just going to mix in some treif burgers with the kosher ones. That would be asur lechatchila. But once it's happened, it's not like, if I ate it, I don't have to go to hell. No, I'm allowed to eat it. Whenever we invoke this notion of bittul, of nullification, it only applies if it's done accidentally. If I pour a drop of milk into my challah on purpose, even though I've got 1,000 grams of challah and 1 gram of milk, that's treif. Or it's not treif, but it's asur.
Does it matter, like, how they got mixed? Like, let's say, like, I'm eating in, like, a dining hall, and, like, the dining hall has, like, some kosher hot dogs and some non-kosher hot dogs. And then when I ask them, I'm like, oh, which pile is the kosher ones? And they're like, I don't know. Like,
great. If like some outside force mixed them together, that is a more complicated question. I'm reminded of Gorelick Farms is a dairy company in New England. And for a while they added shark oil to their milk in order to get vitamin D in it. Shark oil not being kosher. And the VOD of, if I remember correctly the story, I might get it slightly off, the VOD of Boston gave hashkacha to it because the shark oil was less than 1/60th, so there was no flavor of shark oil. And one of my rabbis in college actually said, if it didn't have a heksher, it would be permitted. But because it has a heksher, it's forbidden. Because since they're putting a heksher on it, they're intending it for Jews. And when I do something for Jews, it counts as doing it on purpose. And therefore, it's treif. But if it doesn't have a heksher, then it's made for people in general. So that kind of gets to the complexity of if other people do it. And that's my way of saying I don't want to answer the question right now.
Okay.
But I did want to share that story just because I love it so much. So we've got one scenario. I'm allowed to eat them one after the other, just not all together. Another scenario that Joe and I can split them between the two of us comes in the Ramav of Moshe Islis, the Ashkenazi authority. V'chen yeshlin hog l'chatchila. And that usually be strict, right? Don't eat them all one after the other, says the Ramah. Share it with Joe. Okay? V'yesh machmirin lashlich achad oliten leino Yehudi. And actually, there's an even more stringent view of the Ramah, which is that even if Joe and I split it, it's not okay. But rather, I have to take one, throw it into the ocean, and then I can eat the other two. Even though I don't know that I threw the treif into the ocean, right? And I was learning this with my son yesterday morning, and he pointed out, if you throw it into the ocean, there's actually more chance you're eating treif because there are only two hamburgers now there now. I don't know math well enough to why just it is true, but I think it feels viscerally true. So that's the more stringent view, right? Is they have to throw one into the ocean. Now, here's the thing. If there is something physically wrong with eating treif, then none of this makes sense. Because there is a 67% chance, at least in the first two cases, and someone with better math can tell me if that's true in the third case, that I'm eating treif when I eat these three burgers, or that Joe or I is eating treif when we eat these two burgers, these three burgers, and I should care about Joe's soul as much as I care about my own soul, right? So this does not make any sense if it's about physical experience of treif. So let's try to make sense of this. Why might I say, let's start with the most stringent view. If I say, you got to throw one into the ocean, but then you may eat the other two, why does that make sense? Even though there's a good chance, 50%, 67% chance, whatever it is, that I am now eating a treif burger.
Something about it being it looks exactly the same, the kind of consciousness of it, that just doesn't make it any different, doesn't feel any different to eat it.
It doesn't feel like any different to eat it, and therefore...
Part of it is, I think, in both cases, both when you throw one out and both when you eat all three, you won't know after the fact, I guess, if you eat only one, you won't know after the fact whether the one you ate was treif.
Okay, let's start with this case, because it's going to get more complicated with the other two, right? I throw one into the ocean, I eat the other two. When I eat hamburger one, actually, for that matter, when I eat hamburger one and two, what do I say to myself? What? Yeah! I know there's only a 1 out of 3 chance that I threw the treif one in the ocean, but it's possible. And 1 out of 3, and which is, right, you still need a majority kosher. So it's always going to be the case that there's like a 51% chance you, or whatever, I can't do math. But you get the idea, right? I can always say, like, it's reasonable that I threw the treif one out, even though I don't know that. And therefore, I don't have to assume that when I'm eating burger number one and when I'm eating burger number two, that I'm eating treif. I can say, yeah, the treif one was burger number three. And when I'm done, I could even say I didn't eat treif because the treif one was in the ocean, right? The two that I ate, I don't know it, but it's plausible that they were both kosher burgers.
This is not really, I don't think it's necessarily a reflection of this, but it feels like, at least if we're thinking about kind of perception and how it feels to the person, there's something about setting aside one that we think is not kosher that feels like it makes the other two kosher. Like there's some sort of like metaphysical thing happening, like at least...
Metaphysical or psychological?
Psychological.
Okay, good.
Kind of happening in that process where you're like, okay, I've like made this kadosh, it's now kosher, that one is not kosher, and you've kind of done some sort of mental...
So I think that is metaphysical, you're saying, right?
Yeah.
But why does that work, right? Why do I feel like I throw into the ocean and I've sort of sanctified the other two, made them kosher?
I just thought the reason in this view that you can't eat all three is because if you eat two, you can rely on the fact that there is... higher than 50% chance that you didn't eat a non-kosher item. But if you eat all three, you know that for sure you did.
Great.
And so it's like a different sort of reckoning in eating them all versus eating one at a time.
Great. Ariel?
By setting one aside and labeling that as the non-kosher burger item, then psychologically you're telling yourself the truth that the burger that I'm eating, or the second, or the other one, are kosher.
Great.
Even though if this was me personally, I couldn't imagine eating any three of
Boom.
Great. A plausible, though not definite truth, right? As opposed to if I ate all three of them, the way Rob was saying, well, then I would know that I ate Trafe, right? I might not know at any, with any, like, I'm eating burger number one, I don't know that it's Trafe. I mean, burger number two, I don't know that it's Trafe. I mean, burger number three, I don't know it's Trafe. But once I've eaten all three, I know that I've eaten Trafe. But if I throw one out, at the end of the day, I'd be like, it's plausible that I didn't eat Trafe. So that's the mock view that I have to throw in the ocean. What about the view that says, Joe and I have to divide the three burgers? You have to disregard something I said earlier as false to make this work. Josephine.
You can each say the other person's
own. Okay. I didn't eat the Trafe, Joe did. So the more machmir view is saying, I got to care about Joe also, yes, right? But the middle view is saying, well, I can say that Joe ate the Trafe, Joe can say that Michael ate the Trafe, and we can both feel like we are still good Jews, right? I don't, even though I know one of us ate Trafe, but I can say I didn't. What about the most lenient view, which I think is the hardest one to imagine, right, which is I may eat them one after the other. I, Michael Rosenberg, ate three burgers, one of which I know is Trafe. How do I justify that? Yael?
Well, this is like kind of in the, like, as you are eating them, the justification. And some our last year, actually, Dr. Jeremy talked about this with apples. But if I was understanding correctly, he said, like, the first hamburger you're eating, this isn't the Trafe one. This is a kosher one. In the second hamburger you're eating, there's still two. There's one kosher left. This is the kosher one. And then you get to the last one. You said, well, I probably already ate the Trafe one, so I might as well just eat the kosher hamburger.
Great. So opinions number two and three, the more stringent ones, don't want me even to have imagined myself having done a problem in the past. Right? The most lenient view here, saying, you know what? It's okay to eat all three of them because at no point do I believe that I'm eating yesir. Right? With each burger, I say, this one must be okay. And on the third one, I say, I must have already eaten the Trafe. What can I'm sad about that. What can I do about that? I can't do anything about it, so I may as well eat this third one. But again, the only way to make sense of this is not to say, like, the Trafe burger magically turns into a kosher burger. No one thinks that, right? But rather, it's all about, what's my perception of myself? Do I perceive myself in the most lenient position as always doing something that's plausibly okay? Right? If so, then that's okay. And the second and third positions, do I imagine myself not only doing something that's plausibly okay, but not retroactively imagining myself as having done something that was problematic? If I can imagine that, then I'm okay, even though there are decent odds I'm actually eating Trafe at any given moment.
Our producers for this episode are Sam Greenberg and Jeremy Tabak. Thank you to Nadav Remez for editing this episode. I'm your host, Rabbi Avi Killip. It's been a pleasure to learn with you.